Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell, and along with me as always is my co-host Hannah Buchdahl. Hello, Hannah.
Hey, Charlie.
First of all, I'm going to start off with an apology. It's my week to provide the wine. As always, it's red. As always, it's ready to go. It's poured. And it's not very good, Hannah.
No, it's not. Sorry. I think the stuff I brought you last week was a little bit better.
What you brought last week blows us out of the water. That was a Francis Ford Coppola. I don't even know what kind it was. I didn't read the bottle.
I think it was a Pinot Noir.
This is a Cabernet Sauvignon, and it is not good.
Yeah, sorry.
But, you know. I'm still going to drink it, but it's just not good.
And it's probably not as good as a lot of the movies we saw this week.
However, it is not as good as the first movie I'm going to talk about, which is actually a very, very good movie, and I'm surprised I didn't think it would be. Hannah, what is your opinion on the recent trend of Disney remaking all their old stuff? We've seen Snow White fight sword on sword in hand-to-hand combat now against her stepmother witch in Snow White and the Huntsman. We've seen Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella. We saw Maleficent get a spinoff. She got a spinoff. We got to see her side of the story. And now, what is your opinion on that?
I think it's hit or miss. I think sometimes you just can't mess with a really good original. And other times I think they're providing a good opportunity for a whole new generation to see these stories. And production values have increased dramatically since a lot of the originals came out. So as long as it's done right, I'm okay with it.
Well, yeah, I think they're doing it because you can inject it now with 21st century technology. But on the other hand, I think it's cheating a lot of times. It's not that, they still come out with fresh and original material. Zootopia was Disney. Frozen was Disney, even though Frozen was the worst movie on the planet.
Oh, you're so wrong.
But I think it's cheating when you just go back to your corporation's vault, take out an old movie, spruce it up a little bit, and re-release it. I think it's cheating.
But that's not just with these kids' movies and animated movies. That's happening with all sorts of movies. When all these sequels, but you're going back to the vault to do Barbershop 2 and 3, which we'll talk about later. But, it's just sort of the nature of the beast. If it can make money and it's a sure bet, studios are going to go for it.
Speaking of nature of the beast, they're making another Beauty and the Beast. That'll be out soon. Live action.
Wow.
But so I was not that excited to see The Jungle Book. I was like, oh, great, live action. We're going to see some animals and a kid running around the jungle in his bare feet. Hannah, it's good. It's actually very, very good.
That's what I've heard.
It's surprising how good this is. And I'm shocked because, all right, this was not filmed in India. And in fact, no tree, no leaf, no rock, no piece of ground, no twig. There's an entire lush jungle here is real. It's all fake. This was shot in downtown Los Angeles, Hannah, your old stomping ground. And there's one real thing in it. It's the kid. You have an image in your mind when I say Mowgli. You know what Mowgli looks like. This kid is Mowgli. They did really good. His name is Neil Setti. And Jon Favreau, the director, you know him. He directed Iron Man and Iron Man 2 and Chef.
Mm-hmm.
He's taking on The Jungle Book, the 1967 Disney classic. You remember it's got Blue Bear Necessities. It's based on Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book stories from the 1890s that he wrote for his children. And it looks so real. I would have a hard... I knew I was watching fake animals. That's not a real tiger on screen. It's not a real bear. But good luck convincing your kids out there that these things are fake. They look so real. The tiger, Shere Khan tiger, has got this weight. And when he pounces on things and attacks, he's like, wow, that's an attacking tiger. This is in 3D, so the tiger's jumping at you on screen. I'm not the biggest fan of 3D in this one. I didn't think it needed it. But it didn't necessarily take away too much. I wanted to point out, I love the voices. They picked the correct voices for this because I already identify the characters with them. Baloo the bear, this charming and whimsical bear, is Bill Murray. And I could see Bill Murray
absolutely
lazing down the river singing Bear Necessities. And the mentor, the panther Bagheera, is Ben Kingsley. Okay, he's kind of a mentor kind of guy. And the one that really works the best for me is Scarlett Johansson.
Mm-hmm.
In the original, Ka the Python was a guy. But he was kind of a goofball, trying to hypnotize you with his eyes. Well, here, are you afraid of snakes, Hannah?
I do not like snakes in particular.
Warning to anyone out there in the audience, if you don't like snakes, Ka will give you nightmares.
Ew.
This python is enormous. You never see the full thing because it's so big. But it's got this silky, smooth, seductive Scarlett Johansson voice. And she's wrapping her coils around Mowgli. And like, oh man, this thing, if there's a kid in the audience that doesn't like snakes, it's going to invade his soul, is how real looking this thing is.
I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Well, I'm not taking my three-year-old to see it, but I think every 8-10-year-old out there, this will be their favorite movie of all time. I think it's going to really strike a chord with that age group.
You think they'll like it better than Zootopia?
See, I'm so biased when it comes to that.
I know. I think you obviously liked it way better than Zootopia, certainly visually.
But technically, you shouldn't compare the two because this is not animated.
Absolutely.
It's computer generated.
Yes.
But it's not hand-drawn or anything. It's hand-mouse clicked.
Well, in full disclosure, I did not have an opportunity to see it. I've certainly heard good things about it. It looks really stunning from the trailers that I've seen. And also, I happen to be a huge fan of Jon Favreau as a director, and I love the Iron Man movies. So I knew that if Jon Favreau was at the helm of this, chances are that he would make a movie that would have pretty broad mainstream appeal, and he would make it fun for the audience for the most part.
You know, Jon Favreau should get credit for launching the Marvel Universe. The Iron Man was
absolutely
the first Marvel movie, really, that launched this whole world.
Yeah. He's excellent at blending drama and comedy in a way that very few other directors, and I think part of that's because he's also an actor, and he really just loves the craft, and I think that comes across in a lot of what he does.
And it shows he knows how to make a movie through computers. Iron Man was heavily computerized. Mm-hmm. Green screen was a supporting character. And here, green screen is the main character, really. His boldest choice here was casting another voice actor, and it's casting the King Louis part. In the original, he's an orangutan, and he wants fire, and he kind of rules the apes in that part of the jungle. Here, he's bigger than orangutan. He's called a Gigantopithecus. I guess these things really used to exist, and they were enormous apes. And he cast Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken didn't disguise himself either. He kept his Queen's accent. So I was doing this at work because I was telling everybody about it. He's talking to Mowgli, and he's saying, "Give me the power of man's red flower, Mowgli, and I can help you, and you can help me." And it's funny. It works. And then he sings, and that doesn't work. King Louis has this. He has a song, "I Want to Be Like You. I Want to Be Like You." He wants to be a man. He gets fire. And he sings that song. And man, that doesn't work. Because he sings it in that voice. "I Want to Be Like You, Mowgli."
And I bet you for me it probably does work. So now I'm looking forward to seeing it because I suspect that I will appreciate that.
Well, it works so well because I spent like an hour or two at work till finally people just shut up. Stop talking like this. I think I was briefing someone, and like, yes, and this we're gonna be innovative.
I'm sure they appreciated it.
Yeah, but for whatever reason, I latched on to that. I thought that was really funny. It's not a scene for scene remake. There are differences between this and the animated version. I'm not going to give it away, but the differences work, especially how they treat the man village. So Shere Khan, the tiger, he doesn't trust man. He's already been wounded by man, and he knows the wolves over there are harboring or sheltering this man cub. So the wolves say, "All right, Mowgli, for your safety and ours, kind of, you got to leave the jungle." And he's supposed to go back to his own kind, to the man village. And how they portray that, it's very interesting what the man village looks like and whether or not he actually goes there. So I'm glad Jon Favreau chose to change it a little bit. In conclusion on the Jungle Book, it's really good.
That's good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I was not a huge fan of Life of Pi, so I'm curious, as someone who didn't really love that movie, how this one compares for
it's got a very similar aesthetic.
That's what it looked like.
Really similar. This one, I think, is... I like this better, Life of Pi, as well.
Okay.
I mean, I like the story of Life of Pi better, but this is a better film.
Yeah. So I'm definitely keen to check that one out.
So you didn't get to see The Jungle Book because, well, you had a birthday that night. So exactly. Instead of going to the movies, you went and had a good time.
It was a tough call.
The next night, I couldn't go to the movies because my wife was working late. I had to be a single dad that night. And you had a choice. You could either go see Barbershop 3 or Criminal. Which one did you choose and why?
It was a little tough because I was originally thinking about Criminal because I really like Kevin Costner. And then it turns out that that one was Downtown Washington. And the other one was Barbershop The Next Cut, which was playing 15 minutes away, much closer to get to, and was obviously going to be what I thought probably a lighter movie. And I was not in the mood for a really intense, violent movie. So I opted for Barbershop The Next Cut.
So you did what we always do. We pick movies based on location and and commuting.
Although we have been pretty good about going to far-flung locales.
We went to Georgetown last week.
We did. So we're getting better about those selections just for the sake of seeing a broad mix of movies. But I think I actually probably made the right choice. The buzz on Criminal, which is like the sci-fi thriller crime movie with Kevin Costner, is not very good.
10% on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. That's pretty low.
And so, but a couple of people who have defended it, so I'm not sure that you can immediately dismiss it. I suspect if you're a Kevin Costner fan and you are into the sort of escapist sci-fi, you know, crime drama genre, then you might be interested in going to see it. But I suspect based on the Rotten Tomatoes and the pans that it's getting by many critics that it's not going to do very well. Barbershop, I'm not sure that it's going to do all that much better. It is essentially targeted. It's marketed as, you know, sort of a black movie similar to the Tyler Perry movies. And it's a shame that it's being marketed that way because it has much broader appeal, and I would hope that more people would go and see it. It is a second sequel now to I believe it was 2002 was the first Barbershop movie.
And I liked that movie. I
did
too. I laughed
a
lot.
I do remember really liking Barbershop. It was with Ice Cube and Cedric the Entertainer, and it's a day in the life of this Southside Chicago barbershop, and that's really, everything kind of takes place within the confines of that shop. And it's a lifeline to this community. And it was, I remember it being surprisingly entertaining back then. I don't think I saw the 2004 second.
I did.
Did you?
It wasn't that good.
Yeah, I remember just not hearing enough good things about it to bother. But then this one, the good thing about this one is it takes you back to that barbershop. It's Ice Cube plays this guy, Curtis. I think it's Curtis. Who has a barbershop in the south side of Chicago, and he is debating, things are unraveling. There's a lot of gang violence going on in the community. He's concerned for his teenage son possibly, you know, getting involved in gang activity, and he's contemplating moving the barbershop out of that neighborhood on the south side of Chicago and moving it to the north side. And it is very contemporary. It's very ripped from the headlines. It makes reference to Trayvon Martin and Freddie Gray and just the current violence, the gun violence that's been going on in Chicago recently. And so it feels extremely current. That is both a positive and a negative for this movie. It gets very preachy. It feels a little overacted at times. But the ultimate message is very good, and it really is about these people coming together, deciding, you know, trying to save the barbershop, save the community, and try and rescue these kids from falling into that cycle of poverty and violence that really has just been taking over the streets of the South Side of Chicago.
So it sounds like Ice Cube is thinking about moving the barbershop from White Sox territory up to Wrigley Field.
Exactly.
Well, your description kind of reminds me of Spike Lee's movie from last year, Chi-Raq.
Yes.
You know, obviously totally different genres, different tones, but they're addressing the gang and gun violence in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it's so bad in that movie, they call it Chi-Raq.
Right.
So I remember from Barbershop why it worked so well. was Ice Cube played the straight man, the businessman. I have responsibilities here. I run a business. And right next to him is Cedric the Entertainer. And everyone was laughing because back then it was funny. You had Cedric, it was the first time people were really making light of it. We all know certain things. OJ did it. By then the theater was exploding. Everyone was like, that's so funny. Does that dynamic still there?
It is. Eddie, who is the barber played by Cedric the Entertainer, who nobody trusts to actually cut their hair, so he's really just there as a sympathy employee, but he's the comic relief throughout the movie, and Calvin, who played by Ice Cube,
not Curtis.
I know I was wrong before. It is Calvin. It's Calvin's barbershop. And the Cedric the Entertainer, he says things, as he did in the previous one, that no one else could ever get away with saying. And it is very funny and poignant at the same time, and it definitely works. What's different now, too, is that the barbershop is now co-ed. You have a group of women sort of on one side of the shop who are running, it's now a partnership, and Eve is back as the female lead, sort of playing Calvin's partner in business. And the premise of this movie is you've got these interactions between the women and the men in the barbershop. You've got the customers who are coming through. You have the stuff that's going on outside of the barbershop. And you've got a couple of side stories that are a bit distracting, with like Nicki Minaj as one of the hairdressers who's constantly hitting on one of the male hairdressers who's married to another one. And people in the audience were very vocal about their opinion of the Nicki Minaj character. And they were shouting out things, calling her a hoe and, get away from my man kind of thing. It was very funny, but it was a little much in the movie. It kind of...
Have we ever seen Nicki Minaj in a film before?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen her in bits and pieces of things. Nothing
quite
as often.
It doesn't pop into mind. Maybe she was in Zoolander 2.
I don't know. I did not like... You don't like her. I guess she's playing it well, but you really just don't like her in this movie at least through most of it. It's very timely. It's a great movie for... you would hope that families would go and have a discussion after the fact. And it's definitely geared towards, that whole idea of the Million Man March kind of idea, that you want these dads to really know what's going on with their kids and to take responsibility for raising strong young men and for not killing each other. And it's an attempt to protect their community, and they realize that if it's up to them, it's up to the community to save themselves, and that they're going to need to band together and step up and get these gang leaders to call a truce. And
I'm surprised I'm surprised at the overwhelmingly positive critical response, because that description right there sounds smarmy, and it sounds like this would be pretty bad.
Well, I think what's interesting, it ties up a little too neatly. It all ties up in a very neat bow at the end, which, if only. So I think it's a much lighter tone, a much more accessible tone than a Chirac kind of movie would be. And I think that's what they're going for. So I think they know exactly. It's a pulpit movie. It's a bully pulpit movie, and it's Ice Cube's attempts to just in a very accessible way to get this message out to his community. And I didn't love it entirely, because it really is, it's a day in the life movie. It's still that slice of life within this barbershop. And it is a little too heavy-handed with the messaging, but you can't really argue with a movie that's just trying to do something good. And so ultimately, I think the reason it's getting the positive response is that it's owning this issue and trying to make a difference in a positive way. And so you can't really fault that, even if it's not the best movie ever.
Well, I'm glad to hear that even though it's a third, Barbershop 3, it's taken, you know, it was made seriously, other than another third that was Ice Cube was involved in, which was Friday After Next, which was the third Friday film. Friday After, and that was an awful film. It was him, and I think it was him and Mike Epps.
Well, and even Christmas him and he was in Ride Along 2, wasn't he?
Yes, but they're not up to Ride Along 3.
And so even with Ride Along 2, you felt like he was just kind of phoning it in.
Oh, yeah.
With this movie, you still feel like he's kind of phoning it in. He's preaching to some degree. And so you know that this dialogue was probably written and rewritten up until the very last minute to be as current as possible. And sometimes you feel like it wasn't necessarily actors. It was more, they were not necessarily characters. It was a lot of these actors being very passionate about the message that they were conveying. And so sometimes I felt like it took you out of the characters a bit and felt more like it was, you know, people watching a news segment about the violence in their neighborhood. But ultimately, again, I think it means well. And so I think because it means well and the heart is in the right place, you forgive some of the movie-making flaws that are there.
All right. Well, to finish up, I'm surprised half that Barbershop is a female, because there was already a Barbershop spinoff. It was called Beauty Shop, and it starred Queen Latifah.
Right.
So they already did that before, so I'm surprised they brought it back.
Well, and I think they were just trying to broaden the appeal and bring women into the mix, and this was the best way to do it. I think Beauty Shop might have been like an Atlanta-based beauty shop, whereas this is still very much in Calvin's shop. So it's now Calvin and Eve are partners. It's still very much driven by Calvin's story, but it is an opportunity to just feed you some of these subplots and to inject some of the female perspective.
Well, Barbershop 3 is not the only movie this week about trying to give kids another option, steer kids in another direction. There's another movie like that, much smaller film and set in a completely different location than Chicago. We're talking New Zealand, and we're not even talking like Auckland, New Zealand. We're talking out-of-the-way, rural, poor New Zealand, starring native Maori actors as downtrodden, disenfranchised, poor, poverty-stricken people. And it's about chess. Chess is a mechanism to get kids off the streets, out of gangs, keep them occupied, and you know, open their eyes to other directions they could take in their future. And it's called The Dark Horse. It is based on a real guy. So this is fact-based drama. And it stars Cliff Curtis. Cliff Curtis, he's been a character actor before. He's been Three Kings, Training Day. And people probably know him now. He's an actor in Fear of the Walking Dead.
And he was in The Whale Rider, which was that the New Zealand movie that a lot of people really remember. If you ask if you've ever seen a movie out of New Zealand about the Maori people, you think Whale Rider.
Because Keisha Castle Hughes was nominated for Best Actress in that movie.
And that was an excellent movie. And this one's
actually, I didn't like that movie.
Oh, I love that movie. I thought that was a great movie. And so I think this was similar in tone. And I think anybody who liked Whale Rider will definitely like this movie too.
I think this was darker in tone. At times, hard to watch. There is some violence here. It's almost stomach churning at times. It's about a real man. His name was Genesis. Genesis was a New Zealand chess champion. He was really good at speed chess. And then he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. If he stayed on his pills, it was manageable. But frequently, he was not very good at staying on his pills, and he was in and out of mental institutions. So when we start, he's had another break. He's wandering the streets in the pouring rain. He wanders into a chess shop, and he winds up in a mental institution. And his estranged brother comes to take him home. And this is a last-ditch effort. These guys aren't brothers in the sense of brothers. They're brothers because they just happen to share the same mother. That's about it. And his brother is a gang member, a violent gang member. His house, it's not just a house, it's a gang den. There are people coming in and out at all times, drinking, drugs, violence, planning the next crime they're going to commit. And I'm saying the brother because I forgot his name.
I know. It was,
it's a Maori name.
Yeah, it's a Maori
name. It's like Akiri or something like
that.
He's got a 14-year-old son, just about to turn 15.
Mana.
He wants to get Mana into the gang. He wants to patch him, get him patched. I learned all this terminology from my Sons of Anarchy days.
And I had no idea. That's my problem was watching this movie, the whole gang element. I did not understand a lot of first of all, the dialogue sometimes was difficult to understand.
They have subtitles every now and then.
And you could tell that they probably were going back through the movie and realizing that a lot of people are not going to catch what's being said here, and they actually include subtitles.
Their New Zealand accents take... My ear took a good 20 minutes to tune to it. It is challenging.
Yes.
The gang element is there to show, it's New Zealand, this subculture in New Zealand has a problem, and they are not shy in showing it. This movie is actually based on a documentary. The director saw the documentary. He's like, oh, I can make a movie about this guy. And it's so, to play Genesis is Cliff Curtis. He's launched number one on my best actor list so far this year. He is so good. I can't believe I'm not watching the real Genesis. Like, if I didn't know that this was a real guy, it's like, oh, they found Genesis and they put him on screen. Because he is really convincing.
He is very, very good at playing both when he's on his meds and he's somewhat stable. And you could actually see the transition occurring when he was sort of losing his grip on reality and when he might have gone off the meds and is homeless. You see it in his face and in his eyes, though it's not even just in dialogue. He is very good in relaying emotionally and visually the conflict that's going on as he's trying to emerge from darkness periodically and find a purpose in life.
So the doctors, they let him leave the institution. They give him all his pills, and they say, you know what? You need to have stability. You don't need to have any stress, and you need to find a purpose. And he makes it his purpose to join this this after-school program for disadvantaged, disenfranchised children, at-risk children. And it's a chess club, and it's usually just – they don't really go there to play chess. They go there to socialize and poke fun at each other and scream. But he brings them all chess boards, and he starts teaching them chess. And he says, all right, well, in 6 weeks, I'm going to take you to the New Zealand Chess Championships, and you're going to compete against all the posh – white kids, really. He never says it, but that's what we're all thinking.
Yes.
And that's where this, inevitably, we know it's coming, leads to this van load of tattooed, disheveled children walk into the suit-wearing preppy school, and they're looking back and forth across the room at each other. And actually, even though I knew it was coming, I liked it. It worked.
Yeah, it did. And they were sort of like the breakfast club of New Zealand, for an after-school group. But yeah, it's, a different kind of character. You had the funny kid. You had the smart aleck, the fat kid.
There was the obnoxious girl.
Yeah, you had the one who, he was going to go either way. Either he was going to just not make it through this program and fall out with the club.
There's the kid who was going to play chess or burn down the school.
Yes, right. It's like, oh, I'm either going to do this or burn down the school.
And these kids are good. I liked these kids.
They were all very entertaining and very endearing in their own way.
So I think you're talking when we walked out of the film, it felt a little long, felt a little slow at parts.
Yes.
But now you're more positive than I think you were. I think I liked it better than you did, but now I'm hearing you talk about it in kind of glowing terms.
Well, and I really liked Whale Rider, so I'm surprised you didn't. And so this movie, I tend to like movies based on true stories that are inspirational and where you see the title cards come up at the end that really reinforce that this story ended well and these people were positively impacted for years to come. And again, I think because the performances were so good, it definitely dragged. It had drawbacks for me in terms of it felt like it dragged a bit in the middle. I didn't really get the whole gang thing and how a father could let his child.
We know his motivations, though.
We do know his motivations. He had his reasons. He has his reasons, but it's still really difficult to watch. And so it's sort of anybody who likes the documentaries, like, wordplay about the crossword puzzle aficionados or Mad Hot Ballroom, where you see these kids, become, take on the dance floor. This is sort of that same kind of idea, and it's very nice to see. I didn't totally love it, but I did like it.
I love that it's not a Disney true story because can you imagine this Disney-fied?
Yes.
Like, it really, this packs a punch at times, literally, and that works a lot better than if, say, Disney got a hold of it.
It's hard to tell, because I think sometimes it's the kind of movie that if Disney got a hold of it, it would be definitely a lighter movie, and it might appeal to a bigger audience, and so I'm not sure that as many people will necessarily go to see this movie, which is a great story, as opposed to whether or not it was done as a much more big studio mainstream movie. So it's a catch 22. I'm not sure, it wouldn't be the same movie. It might not be as powerful, but it might reach more people if it was Disney-fied.
It reminded me of McFarland, USA.
Yes.
Kevin Costner last year, Central California, the valleys where the new second generation immigrants are in the fields all day picking fruit and vegetables, and he takes some of their kids, takes them out of the fields and teaches them to run cross country. And I bet the real true story of that was far more like the Dark Horse than the Disney version turned out to be. But I'm glad to see another Maori movie. Like, these we're thinking of two. We're thinking of Whale Rider and now the Dark Horse, and this is 13 years apart. You don't see it a lot, and so I'm glad to see it again.
And it's, I saw there was a movie earlier this year with, it was about Infinitely Polar Bear with Mark Ruffalo, who I absolutely adore. And, he did a very good job playing somebody struggling with mental illness. But that movie ultimately was not as powerful as this one. This one just somehow manages to really let you in better to what's going on with the person with mental illness. And you're rooting for him, and the drama really is in the anticipation of, can he be stable? Can he stay on his meds? Will he disappoint these kids? Will he disappoint himself? Will he end up on the streets? It's a tougher watch, but it's a charming movie in a dramatic, interesting sort of way.
And audiences do like it. It won Best Film and Audience Award at the 2015 Seattle International Film Festival. I've been to that film festival a couple times, and there are hundreds of feature films there. So to win out of that, it really says something. It also won Best Actor at that film festival. Cliff Curtis, I hope people don't forget about this film. He was just so strong.
It is so early in the year that is one of those ones that I would anticipate, or I would hope that when those screeners start coming back around in November of 2016, that he does get remembered, because he is very, very good in it. Again, the language, you have to give yourself a chance. I think this is one where it's more difficult for people to wait and rent it and see it on TV or see it on an airplane. You kind of need to be captive in a theater to really give it the time
to get
into the story. So it is one where, how I feel about subtitles, and when it's actually in English and you still need subtitles.
Well, he was dipping into a native language.
He did. But this is one of those rare ones that if you really like independent films and you are interested in finding it at an art house near you, it's worth seeing in the theater, because it will help keep you focused.
Well, it's not a documentary, even though it's close. It is fact-based drama. But our next one is a documentary. In fact, I think it's our first documentary this year. And I'm actually surprised at the topic, because it's called The First Monday in May, and it's about the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Now, have you ever been to the Met?
I've seen it from outside. I don't know if I've ever gone in.
I haven't gone in either. But the Metropolitan Museum of Art, is closed Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, and the first Monday in May. So I'm thinking in my head, I'm a federal worker, and I don't get the first Monday in May off. Why do they get it? Because there's an annual party, and this is not just a party. This is an exclusive who's who. I mean, Anna Wintour, the editor-in-chief of Vogue, who plans this party, says, I want to keep it intimate this year. Let's only invite 500.
It's the Super Bowl of fashion balls.
It's a party. It's an art exhibit. And it turns out it's so much more.
Yeah.
It's directed by Andrew Rossi. And I saw his previous documentary. It was Page One Inside the New York Times. That was a slice of life of the New York Times trying to weather and stay afloat in the digital age, and all these news aggregators stealing their stuff and would say, no, you still need investigative journalism. You need stringers out there in war zones. And these websites, these Huffington Posts, aren't going to have that. So you need us. So it's weird that he jumps from journalism to party planning. Half this movie's Anna Wintour, who already had her own documentary. That was 2009's The September issue, about how they put together a single issue of Vogue. And half this movie is Andrew Bolton, the curator of the Met's Costume Institute. And he's going to put together a new exhibit. It's called China.
Through the Looking Glass.
Through the Looking Glass. And he's working hand in hand with Anna, who's doing the party side, and how they come together, and how they spend about 8 months to a year planning for this one night.
Yeah, it's one of those documentaries that's designed to pull back the curtain on this, you know, grand event that people normally only see the fashion photos that come from it and the red carpet coverage. People might not even realize sometimes what event they've seen these people in, but like a Sarah Jessica Parker and a Rihanna, when they show up at this event in New York City, it is to them so much more than like walking a red carpet at the Oscars. They go all out. They take everyone takes the theme of whatever the ball is for that year, the gala, and they put on the most ornate, outrageous, crazy, amazing wardrobes. It's hard to even call them dresses because they really are art pieces. And all these big designers, it's their time to shine. And part of what you discover in watching this documentary is how limited it is. It's like the designers have to choose who they are going to bring to this gala to wear their designs. And there's a lot riding on it. And so, you know, you have your Karl Lagerfelds and Jean-Paul Gaultier and, you know, all these different designers who really count on finding that one or two or, you know, maybe three celebrities who can pull off the fashion, but also just cause a stir on the red carpet.
There's a duality to this film. On one hand, Andrew Bolton, the curator, is the intellectual side. He's defending fashion as art. There are those who say there's only high art, painting, architecture, and sculpture. And he's saying, no, fashion is also art. But then you have Karl Lagerfeld, who you just mentioned, who says, no, fashion is an applied art. So he's working, since this is China-based, he has to work a lot with the director of the Asian art department. And that guy, you can just tell, he didn't come out and say it, but he does not think fashion is art. And he thinks it's diminishing the art that's already there. It's lessening it. He says, you want to put ball gowns next to the Buddhas. You know, and he's not having a heart attack, but you can tell he's like, oh, you know, and off to the side with like a handkerchief or something. And on the other side of that duality is Anna Wintour. She is concerned with the seating chart.
Yes.
So this is technically, I guess, for charity. This is funding the Costume Institute's annual budget. So, of course, she seats herself between George Clooney and Bradley Cooper, I noticed.
Yes.
And then it's really very political who sits at what table. And the funniest part about that is there's one table way in the back that they had to squeeze between a couple pillars that Anna is very concerned about. And at you could tell the day of the thing, she's like, oh, I hope there are no celebs at this table. And her assistant says, it's Chloe Sevigny and Solange Knowles. And you're like, oh, man, I hope they watch this movie. And they actually film Chloe when she gets to the table. And it's really funny to see her face.
It's funny how they play some of that. But you'll notice that there are times where they're looking at the seating chart and you can't read.
They blurt it out.
They blur out some of the names of the people that they are poo-pooing that, you know, they could be in exile and, you know, of the room.
They had a list of people they hoped declined the invitation.
Yes,
had one guy who said, all right, you can invite them, but you better tell them to stay off the cell phone.
Yeah.
And yeah, I who are these people? I want to know.
Yeah. And so it was very funny to sort of watch this. I mean, it is event planning to the max. There were some things I really liked about this movie. I like the general idea of showing how this all comes together. I think they're very smart. Their timing, you know, before May 1st, or the first Monday in May is coming up. And so it will
He's good timing.
Do a huge amount to generate interest in the 2016 gala, which is all about, it's going to be about sort of this mesh of fashion and technology, and it'll definitely pique the interest of a lot more people. But this, and it, what I also loved at the beginning of this movie, the detail on the clothing and the red carpet. It's that to me, though, it brings you in, and you're like, oh my God, this stuff is beautiful. And then somewhere in the middle, I think the documentary loses its way for a while. It gets long. You can tell that for political reasons, they're shoehorning in all these tidbits, like the Kardashian little bit. There's a bit with, is it Khloe? I don't even know which one it is.
I don't know my Kardashians.
I don't know my Kardashians. But you can just tell that it's put in there because they're like, well, we got to get the Kardashian angle into this movie. And there were just elements of it that you felt that they were sticking these shots in, strictly because somebody had already promised that they'd be in this, and I didn't feel like it lent itself all that well. And it felt like it ended at least four times. The last half hour of the movie, I thought it was coming back. I was really into it again when the ball finally was when the gala was happening. And then it kept going. I was like, wait a minute, it should have ended with the gala and with these people coming through. And it just kind of went on and on and on, and then it went back into the art exhibit, and it just
there's a lot of Justin Bieber too.
there was a bit of the Biebs in there. He was actually quite entertaining, you know.
He's one way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, he's the Biebs. But there were things I liked about it, but I think this movie is catered that I don't think it's going to have very wide appeal. I think this movie will be adored by people who watch America's Next Top Model, Project Runway, who religiously watch the red carpet shows, who read Vogue magazine. I think that for fashionistas and people who are into design and art and clothing, this movie is probably a gift from heaven. But I don't think that if those things don't strike a chord with you, then I don't think necessarily you're really going to want to sit through it.
Well, I don't know, because those things don't strike a chord with me. I don't watch any of those shows. And I like this documentary. You liked it for the timing and clothing. I liked it for the editing. There's one point where they're talking about Anna Mae Wong, the first major Asian actress, and they're showing her in an old movie. She always played the character called the Dragon Lady, usually running an opium den, or a very powerful lady. And there's a guy talking, it was like a 1930s film, and he says, you watch out for her. She's like a cat swallowing a mouse. And it instantly cuts to Anna Winter.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, that is such a good shot. A brilliant move.
There was definitely a lot of smart editing, but I think what's interesting about this one is, even though I think we both liked it, I think we actually watched it and liked very different parts of it.
Well, I was trying to get the overall theme, the message. Like, is it about the art exhibit? Is it about the clothes? Is it about the celebrities? And then I realized it's not, actually. Andrew Rossi unmasks it at the end. Rihanna's the headliner. She's strutting down the runway, singing her song. And did you notice what the song was? It ties the entire movie together. It's called Bitch Better Have My Money.
I knew it
was
something
like that.
And that's
exactly what the movie's about. It's not charity. It's not. It's paparazzi. It's money. It's about it's about clothing. And it's not altruistic at all. They're using the Met as a facade for Bitch Better Have My Money.
Although I think that Anna Wintour tries to make the argument that you spend money to make money. You do this, you know, that some of the sacrifices that are made in terms of the art are made for the greater good, because this gala actually brings in the entire funding for that costume
institute. For a museum, for a section of a museum. Compare this crowd, this Justin Bieber, you know, who didn't probably take in anything from the exhibit, to what we just saw in the Maori community. And I'm like, the contrast between these movies, which was, you know, I saw one the next day and then one the other day,
yeah,
and are just mind-blowing.
Yeah, I saw them in reverse. I saw the first Monday in May, I think the night before I saw Dark Horse. But I just definitely think that the things that I liked most are the things you probably liked least. I enjoyed watching. I loved seeing these outfits.
Well, that should say something. Actually, I think it should. It won't get wide appeal because there's only going to be like one screen per major city showing this thing. A lot of people aren't going to see it. But it sounds like it really could have mass appeal if given a chance.
I think it would have needed to be tighter. I think it went too long. I think it tried to do a little too much. So I don't know if it would have mass appeal in its current form. I think it has select appeal right now. And people can kind of tune in and out of it and watch what and get from it what they want in terms of the red carpet viewing type of crowd versus the seeing behind the scenes at the Met. I mean, for a lot of people who are museum buffs, this probably gives them a much deeper appreciation for the space and for these exhibit halls and how they are transformed for these various exhibits. So there was that. But I think it just tries to do almost too many things. And I think I would have preferred that it stay a little more focused and just be about really, truly pulling back the curtain on this gala. With Rihanna, one of the most interesting tidbits that's in there is really about how much money she needs to attend.
And so, better have my money.
Yeah. So one of the things I was trying to figure out is whether she was given the headliner role in exchange for not busting their budget as a, as an attendee. It almost seemed there was definitely a whole lot of brokering that goes on between Anna Wintour and these folks and the designers. And so it really is an interesting glimpse into that world. And it definitely pulls back the curtain. And I'm not sure, Rihanna comes off so great when you realize just how much money she requires to participate.
Rihanna travels
to
large.
Participate in a fundraising event. It just seemed a bit hypocritical. And I think a lot of it felt a little hypocritical, and that's part of the issue. But Anna Wintour has no apologies for that, and I think that's a good thing.
All right, well, to wrap it up, there's a very diverse set of movies this week. I think I saw the week's best film, and that was The Jungle Book. Jon Favreau, computer animated, reimagining a beloved animated film, and it works on all levels. It's a great movie. Take your family; everyone's gonna love it. Hannah saw Barbershop 3.
Which I think I would hope more people see it than it is actually marketed to. So if you have teenage kids who you're worried about being involved in not so great stuff, it's a good movie to prompt discussion.
We both saw The Dark Horse, a very indie, out-of-the-way movie about chess in New Zealand. I loved Cliff Curtis. Hannah loved...
I did love Cliff Curtis. I thought he did great. So he was probably the best part of the movie for me. I like this movie a lot, but it does take some concentration.
And our first documentary of the year, we both liked it, but for different reasons. The first Monday in May, Hannah liked Anna Wintour and the party. I liked the museum side.
I liked the dresses. I liked the outfits.
I liked the Chinese accusing us of appropriating their culture for art.
Very different.
So thank you very much for listening once again about these four movies. We hope you go out sometime this weekend to see one of them. And on behalf of myself, Charlie Jewell, charliejewell.com, and Hannah Bookdahl of chickflix.net.
Have a good weekend, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buckdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.